This is the Future of HR podcast, episode 152.
The companies sign up to do a 6-month trial of a 4-day work week, 32 hours, so it's not a compressed work week, really important, and no reduction in pay for their employees. And these are, except in rare circumstances, whole organization changes. So it's not just one division or so forth. So these tend to be, whole company goes on this new schedule, and that's really important. Before they start the schedule, they do 2 months of onboarding in which they go, they have webinars, coaching, they get peer mentorship. And the big purpose of those 2 months is to do what we call work reorganization. So to figure out, where are you wasting time? What is it about your company culture that's dysfunctional? Of course, meetings in the white collar world, number one thing that people start to look at, but also focus time. Like, are people distracted a lot? And if you reduce distractions, people can get so much more done in a shorter period of time. Tremendous improvements in well-being, and we can get into it. Like, what is it? Why is it? And we just published a paper in Nature Human Behavior that explains why it is that working less improves people's well-being. And some of it is what you would expect. They're less fatigued. They're sleeping better. That's really important. So there's the productivity effect. And then the other really key effect, and this turns out to be the key thing for some of the companies, nobody quits a 4-day-week job. So they love the jobs. The value of the job to the employee compared to what else they can get out there in the market, that's really huge in why this thing works.
How can a 4-day work week increase productivity while reducing burnout? Why is a 4-day week working so well for over 300 companies and thousands of employees? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career, to the next level. Since launching the Future of HR podcast in late 2022, I've been fortunate to have meaningful conversations with over 150 HR thought leaders and world-class CHROs from around the globe. These conversations have given me a unique perspective on where HR is today and where we're heading in the future. And because of this vantage point, over the past year, I have had the privilege and opportunity to be a keynote speaker at 16 internal HR conferences for Fortune 500 companies like Kohler, AbbVie, Corning, Nike, LabCorp, and more. And what am I talking about? More often than not, I'm asked to give my signature talk, Future-Proofing HR, Creating Value by Unlocking the Capabilities of Tomorrow, which is designed to help your HR team shift their mindset from being a strategic business partner to a value creator. And these aren't just presentations, they're interactive sessions that equip your HR leaders with practical frameworks to challenge conventional thinking and move beyond the traditional HR playbook. If you're planning your next HR conference, career week, or leadership gathering and want to provide your team with insights that drive immediate impact, I'd love to connect and explore how I might help make your event a big success. Feel free to reach out to me at jp@futureofhr.com to start the conversation. And with that, my guest this week is Juliette Shore. Juliette is an economist and sociologist at Boston College. And before joining Boston College, she taught at Harvard University for 17 years. Juliette has been researching and writing about how we work and how long we work for her entire career. She's authored or co-authored countless books, research, and journal articles over her career, and she wrote the bestseller, The Overworked American, The Unexpected Decline of Leisure, which laid out in the early 1990s that despite advances in technology, most of us are working harder and longer than ever before. And in recent years, Juliette's research has focused on the 4-day week. To do this, Juliette and other researchers have led the largest study of the 4-day work week yet, where they tested a unique series of trials where companies are offering a 32-hour week with no reduction in pay. Now, I know what you're thinking. It sounds too good to be true. My company could never operate on a 4-day work week. Well, before you dismiss the idea, let me tell you that over 350 companies and more than 10,000 employees around the world have participated in this study, and the results are astounding. Now, how did those 350 companies implement a 4-day work week? Well, that's exactly what Juliet lays out in her latest book, 4 Days a Week, The Life-Changing Solution for Reducing Employee Stress, Improving Well-Being, and Working Smarter. And it's exactly what Juliet and I talked about as well. This was an insightful conversation, and I left inspired as we discussed why, despite decades of labor-saving technology, Americans are working longer hours than ever before, why rethinking productivity is only part of the business case for a 4-day work week, how work redesign is the key to unlocking both productivity and employee well-being, how a 4-day work week dramatically improves retention and makes you an employer of choice, and the real-world examples of 4-day work weeks in tech startups, large manufacturing, and even restaurants. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode as you listen, so drop me a line on LinkedIn and say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Juliet. Juliet, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me.
We're excited to have you. You have been doing some amazing work and research, and you've written a book called The 4 Days a Week, which we'll talk a little more about what this book's all about. I think it's revolutionary. We're not talking enough about it in HR, but you say in the introduction to 4 Days a Week that the origins of the book go back 40 years. Can you tell us more about that and what led you to write the book?
40 years ago, I was a brand new assistant professor. I was teaching in the economics department at Harvard, and I was reading a book that was written by some colleagues of my advisors, my graduate school advisors. Very distinguished person had written this book, and there was a page and a half that was wrong. Wrong in the sense that it was about how market economies have a tendency to take productivity growth in the form of more production rather than giving people time off. I think that's true, that market economies do have that tendency, but the explanation was wrong. So I wrote a little paper. It was a little model theory, very kind of academic. And I was pretty pleased with myself that I'd found this flaw in this very famous man's book. But that got me interested in the question of working hours. Like, what has happened to working hours? Actually, I was saying there was this bias towards more production. Well, is that what we were seeing? And so I started diving into the numbers. And what I found was, contrary to all the expectations, Americans were actually working more hours than they had. And that had gone up for about 20 years. So I wrote a book called The Overworked American, The Unexpected Decline of Leisure, and that turned into a like national bestseller. And that's how I got into this topic.
It's your point on this idea of we get productivity gains, right? We have all these amazing things that can help us do things faster, whether you talk about Excel from a calculator to now we have AI, but we're not getting those gains back in leisure time. What's happening is we're filling in the workday more even. I feel like it's actually, we're increasing our workload. We're going from 40 to more, working on the weekends, working at night. It's not helping us get this lifestyle of saying, I can quit at 5 o'clock and go be with my kids or whatever. Tell us more about that tension point is and for that research you've done over the past 40 years.
That was really the question. Why is it that all this labor-saving technical change hasn't necessarily saved us labor? So I started way back in history, like even pre-industrial revolution. And so the first part of the book was like, look what happened to working hours as all these new technologies came in with the industrial revolution. So you get this massive increase in work time starting in the 18th century, but then through toward the last part of the 19th century, where you've got these factories, people are working 12-hour days. They may not even be getting Sundays off. This sort of level of work effort that is unprecedented in human history comes about as a result of labor-saving technology. So that's like such a paradox, right? And then eventually working hours start to come down because you have a backlash. You have child labor laws. You have laws protecting women's hours. You have labor unions, et cetera. So from 1875 through till about 1970 or so, you have a long decline in working hours. The U.S. leads that decline. The other early industrializing countries also follow. But what happens there then is that the U.S. diverges from everybody else. They all stay on that hours reduction path. And in the U.S., we start going in the other direction. There are a number of different reasons for this. Some of them have to do with the incentives facing the companies. Like if you're paying health insurance per person, you don't want people working short hours because then you have to hire more people. That was a big one. People going on salaried work. So then all those extra hours they work are free to the employer. That was another one. But I think the other thing that has happened, especially in white collar work in recent years with the sort of digital revolution, which hadn't happened by 1970, that's not happening yet, is to be really kind of popular about it, the Parkinson's Law thing, which is that once we stabilized the 5-day week, we stabilized at that official 40 hours, even though people were working more and more in the white collar world and also in the blue collar world. But if there was no possibility of reducing hours and you had all this labor saving technology, you're just going to fill it up that time. And one of the companies that I profile a lot in the book, it's a PR and marketing firm. He talked a lot about that because that business changed so much. They used to have to fax things or, you know, drive copy to clients. And suddenly they're saving massive amounts of time. And then during the pandemic, when he didn't have to commute, he thought, and now I have another hours a day of free time. I'm going to do all this stuff for myself. And he found himself working just as long.
It's really helpful to hear that history. Thank you for doing that. Because I think it's so hard to understand why we aren't seeing that. And I think there's some promise around AI, which we're not going to get into too much, but like the promise of, again, another technology that's going to save us time and take our transactional work away. But I can just tell you that if I use AI to write an email or help me do something, I don't get that time back. I just do more, right? That's what I feel like you're just doing more. And so I think that's a really dichotomy, which is why your book, I think, is interesting and insightful in some ways, just really counterintuitive. Make sure I've got this right, but your research, my understanding, is the largest study of the 4-day work week yet. It covers 245 organizations, over 8,700 employees. So tell us more about what you found, and did the results surprise you? Did you see the same trend? Can we get to a 4-day work week?
Yes, we have companies all over the world, and the book relies on, because I had to put a stop in terms of doing the data analysis and so forth. We have many more companies since that point, maybe close to 150 more have participated in these experiments. The companies sign up to do a 6-month trial of a 4-day work week, 32 hours. So it's not a compressed work week, really important, and no reduction in pay for their employees. And these are, except in rare circumstances, whole organization changes. So it's not just one division or so forth. So these tend to be, whole company goes on this new schedule. And that's really important. Before they start the schedule, they do 2 months of onboarding in which they have webinars, coaching, they get peer mentorship. And the big purpose of those 2 months is to do what we call work reorganization. So to figure out, where are you wasting time? What is it about your company culture that's dysfunctional? Of course, meetings in the white collar world, number one thing that people start to look at, but also focus time. Like, are people distracted a lot? And if you reduce distractions, people can get so much more done in a shorter period of time. But we have all kinds of companies, so they do this in different ways. We have a restaurant that I profile in the book. They had one meeting a week. It was a perfect meeting. They didn't need to change that at all. They had to do other things. Or the manufacturing companies, they do process engineering. So they go through every step in their process and figure out how they could do things differently. They might sequence differently. At the brewery I profile, there's a lot of downtime with some of the operations. And instead of just doing things sequentially, they started slotting in new tasks in that downtime. So lots of different ways that companies figure out how to save time. And also what some of them figure out, things that they're doing that really aren't adding much value, but that take a lot of time. So they might get rid of those things. So also changing what they do. Then they're off. After the 8 weeks, they go to the 4-day schedule. They have to figure out exactly how they're going to do it. We can get into that. And then we're surveying them before they start, at 3 months, at 6 months, at 12 months, at 24 months. So we know these findings are really durable. What do we find? We have 20 well-being metrics. We have burnout and stress, anxiety, fatigue, exercise, sleep problems, satisfaction, work-family conflict, work-life conflict, all of those negative emotions, positive emotions, all of them show significant large-scale improvement. Just about 70% of people score lower on the burnout scale at 3 months. It's really startling. So tremendous improvements in well-being, and we can get into it. Like, what is it? Why is it? We just published a paper in Nature Human Behavior that explains why it is that working less improves people's well-being. And some of it is what you would expect. They're less fatigued. They're sleeping better. That's really important. But the other half, that's about half. The other half is really fascinating. People are more productive. We have self-report productivity measures, a number of different measures. We have a smart working scale where we're measuring people before they start. And that improvement in their sense of their capacity at their job, we have a question called, how does your current workability compare to your lifetime best? And that soars. That improves well-being, but of course, it's also key to the basis of why it's working for the companies, which is in part because this model of maintaining the productivity in 4 days, like if it was just companies giving people a day off, no reduction in pay, and everything else stayed the same, that's going to be a hit for the companies, obviously. That's not going to work. So figuring out how to be as productive in the 4 days as the five, where we're seeing the employees reporting that enhanced sense of productivity, capacity, smart working. And the company's also telling us the same thing. And we can get into that in a minute. But so that's the employee side of things, and almost no speed up, because we're also worrying, well, is it just that people have to work faster? No, minuscule little bit of uptick in that, but really pretty small. So there's the productivity effect. And then the other really key effect, and this turns out to be the key thing for some of the companies, nobody quits a 4-day-week job. They love the jobs. They value the jobs so much. And we can come back to that. But the value of the job to the employee compared to what else they can get out there in the market, that's really huge in why this thing works.
That is amazing. And yeah, I guess the thinking about it and hearing you talk through, it's really about, in some ways, work and job redesign. Because you're asking the companies to say, how do we let go of things that were inefficient, that weren't helping us, and really focus in on what is productivity, the best way to do things, so that we can get this 4-day work week. So that's the first piece. Then the second piece that you're talking through, and I don't know, this is a way too simple of an explanation, but I believe the constraints really drive innovation and creativity. And so the constraint of 4 days, by saying if we have to make this work in 4 days, people think of new solutions they probably never thought of before. Like, we don't need that meeting. Like you said, new tasks and this different downtime, right? And you did it across all these industries. So that's amazing. And I think I can't wait to dig into more of it. There's some skeptics out there, of course. They're going to say, tell us more about this. I am curious, just from my own skepticism, the size of the organizations. I can see a small company be able to make this happen a lot easier, but what was the largest company and how did they manage this?
We have one that's a 35,000 that only did it with a few divisions. We have a 9,000. So in terms of companies that did it company-wide, the biggest one is It was a 5,000 person company that started with 1,000 and then has rolled it out to all 5,000. But you're right. These are mostly small companies doing it. And there are two reasons for that. One is, if you're a big company, why would you take part in a trial like this? Why would you? Eventually, they started having to pay the NGO some money, and you hire your own consultants or you have your own HR people who figure it out. But the size is creeping up is one of the things I would say. So we are getting more in the 500 to 1,000 person. We have a 1,000 person social service agency we're working with now, and they're doing it division by division, but they're rolling out across their organization. So that is a little bit an artifact of the trial setup. And then the other thing is just, I just think the big ones are, they're more like an ocean liner, that getting them to turn is a little bit harder. A lot of these companies have either founders who are running them or startups. They're more nimble. They're able to experiment a little bit more easily. One of our collaborators is in the process of finalizing a plan with a 50,000 person multinational manufacturing company. I think it's been going on, it feels like about a year already. I think in the fall they're going to finalize, but that's how long the conversation about doing with this with a couple of divisions has taken. So it's just the really big ones are a different animal, but I don't know that there's anything specific about them that would make it impossible. And I hear from big ones. I had a 150,000 person firm contact me, and we had extensive conversations. And it's funny, some people write in and say, how could this possibly work for small business? And of course, it's the smaller ones that are really leading the way, which is the way it happened for the 5-day week too, which I find really interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think it's a great perspective. Now, we started this conversation saying 245 organizations have done this. You added another 100 or so. So you're well over 300 organizations that have been through this and are adopting it. And I think that shows that this is something that has legs, and there's some really great concepts that maybe big companies can apply, because we know they want more. They want better well-being, greater retention, productivity, all those good things as well. It's just harder to move the ship, as you talked about. Now, the other thing I want to talk about, Juliet, around this, and again, not being skeptical, but I'm sure you have to go through all the things of why this can't work, because it's a radical paradigm shift. I mean, just like going to 5 days work, a work week probably was at the time, a 4-day work week sounds really different, especially in the United States, and maybe in our typical environment of where we're at today. But a lot of CEOs and HR leaders might say 4-day work week and maybe think, gosh, how do we maintain productivity? Can you walk us through that a little bit more? And I know you have this 180-100 model that would love to just everyone to understand more in depth.
180-100 model. Let me just add one thing after we talk about that, is to say we've got to broaden the conversation from just productivity narrowly defined to the full cost calculation for the companies, because that's what really matters. Right? It's sort of, what are the costs and benefits of this? How does it affect your bottom line? Productivity is only one of the things that affects your bottom line. Also, your cost of labor matters and so forth. So 180-100 refers to 100% of the pay for 80% of the work, but you get 100% of the output. That 2 months of work reorganization is the sort of process by which companies try and figure out how to make that happen. Now, that does vary a lot. The man who started, you know, invented that terminology and whose book, The 4-Day Week, got this organization going is a man named Andrew Barnes. He's an entrepreneur in New Zealand. He has a financial services company. He did this at his company in, I believe it was 2018. He had a very individualist approach to this, where he made up a contract and every person had to sign it. If you're going to get the 4-day week, you have to promise to do 5 days work in four. Now, some of the companies have that more individual perspective, and that is an important thing that's going on, because a lot of these people have a certain amount of individual discretion in how they spend their time. They're also able to spend time, maybe a certain amount of social chatting or socialization at the workforce, or maybe they're just wasting time on their computer. We did not study that. people have ways that as individuals, they can make themselves more productive, knowing that they've got to get everything done in the 4 days. But the big emphasis is on the whole organization changes, because a lot of where people are wasting time is in things that the organization is directing them to do, whether it's to fill out forms that don't really provide that much value, or to sit in meetings that are useless for them, or to sit in meetings that go on too long, or to have meetings that could have been emails instead, or you know all the ways that that happens. So the organizations figure it out very differently. One of the companies I profile in the book is Kickstarter, which is interesting for me. I was able to look at different levels of the organization, and they figured out different things. So at the senior leadership level, what they realized was it's a technology company. They have a website for crowdfunding of projects. So when the senior leadership would tell all of their developers, product developers and so forth, we want this, what they saw happening was they give the orders or whatever instructions, the teams would go forward, they'd come to a fork in the road, they weren't sure which direction to go, they'd go down one direction, then it turned out it wasn't what senior leadership wanted. And so they would waste a lot of time there. So everything was taking longer. Senior leadership realized it had to do more work before it gave instructions. And that ended up saving them a lot of time. So when I went to a lower level, just at that sort of bottom team level and talked to those folks, they went through that start, stop, continue process with everything that they were doing and figured out a whole range of things that they could do to save time. That happened in the manufacturing context. So one of the manufacturing firms, for example, they figured out that one guy on the floor was a lot better at a certain task than the other people. So they changed the distribution of labor and had him do that task all the time. Or sometimes they'll spend a little bit of money. So new software is something that a lot of companies did to help them either with distractions or calendar management or project management. That manufacturing company bought a new machine. They didn't spend too much on it, but a little bit. They more than made it back in worker happiness and so forth. So lots of different ways. I think the key point is it is that combination of the individual and the company changes. But I think the company part is really important.
That's really helpful. And so even in this idea of 180-100, even if it's more individualistic, these companies in your research really signed up for the 32 hours. So they said, hey, we want you to get this work done in 4 days. We're not expecting you to work 60 hours in 4 days and really just get your fifth day done and have a long weekend. It was like, we expect you to still have some balance, but now it's really about being much more effective, thinking differently about the work. That's helpful. Because I want to make sure we understand that, because I don't want people to start thinking that we just jammed it in. It sounds like that's not what these companies are doing, which is amazing.
That doesn't work to get the levels of well-being impacts and other kinds of impacts that we're seeing. And I have like people, irate people writing to me when after they've heard me talk about this, where they maybe could listen a little more carefully, or maybe it's just like bad stories in the newspaper. But I have people writing to me and saying, I was on those 4-10s and I hated it. It ruined my life. That's not what's happening here. It's 4-8s. Yes, you have to reorganize work. You've got to do some things differently to figure out how to get it all done in those 32 hours. But what we're hearing from these companies is that they're able to do that. So that shows they're not at a level of intensity with this workflow that prevents that. But that gets us to the other category of companies, the ones I call 180-80s. Because there are organizations and companies where they've already done all this. They don't have any wasted time. And the places where we're seeing that are in healthcare. We're seeing it in restaurants. I love the restaurant example. If you think about how like a successful restaurant kitchen operates, they're not sitting around having meetings. They're not wasting time. They're at like a peak intensity while that process is going on. And they have really long hours and they have incredible burnout. A small restaurant chain, they have four locations, came to us and said, we want to do this, we're going to start with our chefs and managers because they have the longest hours. So they have 55-hour weeks. So these are not 40-hour low-key office workers. But they're losing a lot of people to resignations and burnout. And it's just a really intense environment. And it's four locations. So these are big restaurants. I think one of them is a 400-seat restaurant. So these are complicated operations. They just said, okay, all chefs and general managers, you've got a day off. We can't affect your hours on the day that you're in because that's dictated by how the restaurant being open, but you have a free day. You don't have to worry about anything on that day off. They managed it through a combination of things. They did a little bit of hiring. So they hired some hourly management people. So that was a lot cheaper than hiring full-time salaried new general managers. They upskilled some of the kitchen staff. And so they took over some of the work that the chefs had done. Anyway, they managed it through this variety of things that the cost was trivial to them, and they got phenomenal results. They got really big improvements in service quality. And the other really big thing is people stopped leaving. And they also were able to attract new people who were just better because they're offering something that nobody in their industry has. They are in a really high turnover industry. Turnover just goes away when you give a four-day week.
Yeah, which is a huge cost for the restaurant industry, manufacturing, et cetera, those kind of hourly or blue-collar type work environments where it's really manual. It's hard. Burnout makes a lot of sense. So I could see that being a huge reason why you want to stay and work. And the service quality in a restaurant, if you've got chefs and sous chefs and everyone knows how everything works, the food has to get better over time, right? So that's a really important piece. And if you could do it in a restaurant, I mean, gosh, you can't tell me you can't do this in a smaller or even a mid-size, I think 5,000 people firm you talked about, that's a big company to me. 5,000 people is not small. But Juliet, how do you see, let's talk about the technology here. I mean, it sounds like it's working. The number one, leadership has to be committed to this. They've got to make the tough choices and get rid of the sacred cows and really say, we're going to recommit to designing work, which probably means the leaders also have to believe in the full scale of costs, to your point, not just productivity, not just revenue, but hey, how do we manage costs? How do we have great well-being? How do we reduce turnover, have committed employees, and believing that that virtuous cycle actually does lead to higher profits? Did you see that some companies get better results because of the 4-day work week and actually grew their top line or bottom lines?
Absolutely. We have really good revenue results on average for our trials. We have a lot of startups who are growing rapidly. Here's a great example of one. It's an internet service provider in Northern Canada. They are providing internet service to remote rural communities. It's a startup. At the same time they started their 4-day week, they got a massive new contract, which meant a huge increase in the amount of work that they had to do. I mean, basically what they do is they've got to solve all the customer complaints of people having issues with the connectivity and so forth. So it's a very labor intensive kind of operation. And we interviewed them before they started the trial. They hadn't told us, I don't think they'd had the contract yet, or it didn't come up in the interviews. But then we come back to them 6 months later and they had to go and they tell us about this. And my first question was, that must have been really hard with the 4-day week. They said, no, actually, I don't think we could have done it without the 4-day week. So there are two reasons for it. And one gets back to something that you've talked about. So there were two reasons for why the 4-day week allowed them to expand their business so much. The first was they thought people would have burned out more if they were working 5 days with this new level of demand. So that was interesting. So they kept their people despite, more work. But the second one is what I call in the book, the forcing function of the 4-day week. I think you use the term constraint, the 4-day week as a constraint, same point, which is the 4-day week forced them to do things that they should have done before, but they never got around to. So in their case, it was documentation. When you're dealing with sort of technology-based customer service, You don't want each of those customer service people reinventing the wheel of the problem. A lot of them are common problems, but they hadn't been documenting enough. So they got really serious about their documentation, and that allowed them to save massive amounts of time. And I asked people I interviewed for the book about this. Well, like, here are these things you could have done. A documentation is one. I mean, I think we all, or many of us, do this. Like, we get a new piece of software or a new technology, and we don't spend the time at the beginning figuring out all the ways it could help us, right? We just start using it. And we learn along the way, but, or we don't, right? And I mean, I think of the many technologies I have that I use at only a small fraction of their capabilities. That's a similar point. It's doing the work up front. But then we could say the same thing about the meetings or the focus time. Like, why haven't you done this already? This is not rocket science. It doesn't cost anything. Time and again, what these people would say to me was, we're just trying to keep our heads above water, or nobody acts like that. It's just, there's a level of kind of failing to optimize. Now, there's a guy named Herb Simon who got a Nobel Prize in economics for this. He called it satisficing rather than optimizing. But it's just really rampant throughout the economy.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, that forcing function, and maybe that's where I got it from your book. I don't know. I think that made that idea. But I definitely have seen that even in my own creativity, where when you only have so many hours to get something done, all of a sudden you produce the work in that time period. And I forget the other rule, where we allow whatever time period we have to get something done to suck up that whole time period. Let's talk about generative AI just briefly, because I think there'll be a question that people are on people's minds. Juliet, do you see generative AI enabling a shorter work week in the coming years? Do you see us keep using this trend of, like, oh, it's now it's taking some other work away, I'm going to fill it up with other work? Or is it, if you're doing a 4-day work week, it's going to be really empowering and helpful? But if not, you're probably going to have the same things happening we're seeing today. How do you see that from an economist perspective?
There are a couple of really interesting things. If you're not intentional about it, you could get that Parkinson's law. So people use it, it saves time, but then something else just fills it up or kind of gets wasted in some way. The other thing is, for the more certain kind of company, I think the bigger ones will be more likely to do this. You could just see a lot of layoffs. I don't see that the economy is going to generate that much more demand for labor in other places and so forth that is going to avoid the creeping larger and larger levels of sort of structural unemployment. That causes a big problem at a social level. It may not be a problem for an individual company. So that's possible. But I think the optimal response is the one where the company says, we're saving time. We're not going to lay you off. We're going to give some of that back to you by just giving you ideally the 4-day week, because it's more valuable to people than sort of small increments on a daily basis. It's a life transforming change for many, many people to have that third day off. AI enables work time reduction. I think a lot of the people who are thinking ahead about the future of work, including many famous people like Bill Gates and Jamie Dimon and Steve Cohen, and these people are all predicting, they're actually predicting like a 3-day week, 3.5-day week. I think that's very possible. We have to be intentional about it. I don't think it's just going to happen without some sort of social conversation about it, without like really saying that we're going to try and go in this direction, because that 5-day week's been very, very sticky. We've had it for 85 years. But there's one other fascinating thing that I'm also hearing. I got contacted by a guy it's a startup. He's the founder of an AI startup. They build agentic AI. And he said the work is so mentally taxing and emotionally taxing that he had to give people a 4-day week. And so they've gone to a 4-day week, not being enabled by AI, but being, in a way, forced by the nature of the work. Now, of course, not everybody's building AI, but AI may turn out to be, as it gets more sophisticated, it may just turn out to be more mentally taxing kind of interactions than some of the things that we've been doing, like the technology that we've had so far. And I think you could also say that one of the reasons that this possibility for consolidating productivity into 4 days has occurred is that knowledge work is, it's mentally taxing, and people can't work at that high level for 5 days in a row for 8 hours or more. And that actually, I mean, I can say for myself as a researcher and a writer, I can't write for 8 straight hours a day. There's a point, maybe I can do 4 or maybe I can do 6, and then I'm dead. It's like, it's gone. The creativity's gone. I've got to do something kind of low level or, you know, busy work or something, because my brain just can't take it. And I think that is also, I can't give you any numbers on that. I think that's also something that has made this so feasible for knowledge workers to go from the 5 to the 4, because you can do it in 4 with less exhaustion mentally.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Looking at the research, where do you see the movement heading over the next 5 years? Do you see more companies adopting the 4-day work week? Are there certain industries you think that will lead the way, or do you see it retreating and not getting the traction?
Earlier on in our conversation, you referenced, like, why isn't this getting more take up than it is? I mean, there's so much research here, lots of evidence and a lot of common sense to it and so forth. I do think at the moment, the AI conversation is just dominating everything and really making it hard for other dimensions of work to break through. But that'll subside. Not that AI is going to subside, but just that the fixation on AI may subside. And as people use it more and more, there's survey evidence from companies that are either on 4-day weeks or considering it, which show those companies have higher proficiency with AI and they use it more. We're going to increasingly see that AI and the 4-day week are quite symbiotic, both because of its time-saving capabilities and also because of its sort of mentally draining dimensions. You're going to see AI proficient 4-day week companies. So I think the movement really has legs. Part of why I think that is looking into that 5-day week, because the path to a 5-day week looks so similar to what we're seeing today with the 4-day.
Really interesting. Very helpful. Juliet, what's one piece of advice you'd like to give to an HR leader who's listening and thinking and maybe proposing 4 days a week concepts to their organization, or maybe even going all in? How do they get started?
Okay, well, obviously, I'd love them to read my book. But aside from that, we've encountered cases where we've got HR folks who are really interested. And of course, then they've got to go to senior management to sell it or convince them. There are a couple of things. Sometimes they contact me and I do a presentation, and I'm always happy to do that for a company if there's interest. But I think one of the key things I've learned, and especially from the one quote unquote failure case that I go into detail with in the book, which is about a startup, about a 200 person startup, where the whole impetus was from the head of HR. The CEO was kind of skeptical. I mean, they didn't do a company-wide pilot. They did it with just a small number of people, and I think that just doomed it. But what the CEO was interested in, and part of why they ended the pilot, was metrics. The CEO really cared about being able to show that this was working. So there's the well-being metrics, but also those productivity metrics. And the company hadn't really nailed down its own performance metrics well enough before the trial started to know whether or not it was working. And I mean, they were growing very rapidly, so they knew that was happening. But having those metrics and knowing what it is that will constitute success or failure is really key beforehand. And so getting clear on that. So I think if I were an HR person going in, I would, going into my CEO or C-suite people or so forth, I would be pretty clear, at least on an initial set of things, that I would say, well, these are the things I think that we will see change in, and that if we do, that would be success.
Yeah, it sounds like also thinking about the ROI return on investment and the metrics. So that's what CEOs care about typically and leaders. So prove to me this works. Don't just tell me people love the 4-day work week. Of course, they love the 4-day work week. I can imagine that conversation right now with the CEO. Julia, last question for you. I'm going to ask all my guests this question. What's one word or phrase you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, I'm going to say work time reduction, or maybe the 4-day week, because I really do think it's going to be central. People are struggling at levels that we really haven't seen before. These are the pandemic level struggling has not gone away. It's abated a little bit, but if you look at most of the numbers, it came down slightly and it's plateaued. And I think HR professionals need to deal with solutions that actually really make a difference there. And most of what we've been doing to date hasn't, but the 4-day week does.
Julia, this has been a great conversation. Thank you for helping us understand the 4-day work week. I hope we get there. I would love it. Thanks again for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR Podcast. Thanks again to Juliette for sharing her research and insights on how over 350 companies have implemented the 4-day work week. As always, you can go to thefutureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, I think you'll enjoy my Future of HR newsletter, which is the only newsletter that's focused on helping to elevate your career and your business impact. Go to Future of HR now to subscribe and be sure to download my HR Leaders Blueprint, which is 18 pages of real-world advice from 100 plus HR thought leaders with simple, actionable, and proven strategies to advance your career. We'll be back next week with another amazing guest. Until then, thanks for being part of the Future of HR community.